Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
I'm your other half, Darren Bresnitz. We are coming to you from New York City.
Down on Wall Street.
Wall Street.
You got to see the Oculus for the first time.
I did. Food never sleeps. Am I right?
Food never sleeps?
Yeah.
Is that a saying?
I mean, money never sleeps. Wall Street.
Right. But food sleeps.
Maybe. We've got a good show this week. We are going international. First stop in the show is Paris.
We have Camille Fremont, who is in town this week, who's going to do a couple of events, one with Danny from Mission Chinese on Wednesday, and one from our absolute favorite place in the world, Achilles Heel, with Lee on Thursday. She will be doing some wine pouring. She will be serving up some of the classic dishes from her wine shop called La Buvette, which is in Paris. And she'll just be around hanging out. We had a good conversation with her about her trips to Damascus and how she got to where she is today.
And you did the interview in Paris.
In Paris.
I guess my invitation was lost.
It was lost.
And then in the second half of the show, we have one of our favorites, Miss Annie Hart, playing live. Her new album came out this week.
Friday. 48 hours ago.
It's phenomenal. It's great. If you follow her on Instagram, you've been seeing a lot of previews of it. She recorded it in her basement while her kids slept. And it's beautiful. It's fun. It's great. It's her, and she's going to be playing. And the kids will be here, too.
Yeah. And, of course, we're going to talk about her performances with Alvar Simone on Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And we're going to eat a lot of pizza.
Ton of pizza.
So here we go. Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz, coming to you from Paris, France, in a shuttered La Buvette with chef, owner, wine server, table cleaner, olive setter, cheese giver.
Slicer.
Camille Fromont. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hello.
Thank you for having us here.
My pleasure. It's great to have you.
So you were born in Orleans between two fields of wheat and poppies.
Yeah, that's the poetic version.
It's really nice. tell me about your childhood growing up and your parents and your upbringing and the kind of food that you ate.
I was born in a very like simple family, just a brother, a mother and a father, basic. And food has always been something important, but not special. I don't know how to explain the difference between both. But, I mean, my mother was cooking all the time. She could have spent, like, 3 days in the kitchen for, like, a special Saturday dinner with some friends. But she always made the same care about cooking even, like, fish sticks for, like, an easy lunch, like a quick lunch back from school. So I didn't get this, like, culture of restaurant, like, going out, having, like, some big dinner in restaurants or stuff. But the fact of being all together to share a moment around the table was more important than anything. So that's how it started, more than the food itself, if I could say.
It was the community, family vibes.
Yeah, I've never seen not waiting for my father to have the dinner together or something. We never had any like TV trails or like that was totally forbidden.
You went to school to study Oriental languages first. How did you get interested in that and where was the inspiration for that education?
That comes from a part of my family, but that I never met. My mother, grandmother, she used to live in North Africa, in Tunisia and in Morocco. She used to be a teacher like there. And they never came back when all French people came back, you know, in France after like some trouble there. And so since I'm a child, there is some souvenir of this part of the life of this part of my family in my house. But I never knew anything about it. So I was maybe a bit curious. So I started learning like just few courses a week at high school, like lycée is high school. Just a couple of hours a week, and that was not a very good level, but that was interesting. So this is how I started slowly, and then I just get an obsession about coming to Paris. So I was wondering, how can I do that to be sure that I won't fail in going to Paris? So I just choose the two courses. Well, should I say that? That I can do to make sure that it's only in Paris. So Arabic was only in Paris. So good reason or not, that was one of the reasons.
That's so incredible.
That's a mix of.
No, I know, but that's so incredible. Be like, how do I get here? And they can't say, oh, go here, go somewhere else. It's like, there's only Arabic in Paris. I must go to Paris.
Exactly.
But you studied for 6 years.
Yeah.
And you also went to Damascus as well as part
of
a scholarship.
I lived there for, yeah.
And what was that experience like?
Amazing. Unforgettable. Like, just opened my head in two to like some so different people, like way of life, culture, food. Like, that was crazy.
What were some of the food memories that you still have from being in Damascus?
The first day when I arrived, I met some people. I was in a kind of, like, small hotel where there were, like, only, like, young people traveling. And I just arrived and someone brought me to the main souk, like, the market. And there were some kind of ice creams, milk ice creams. Very, a kind of rubbery, like super strange consistence, like in a in a biscuit cone. It's like a huge white piece of ice cream in the biscuit cone. Like, I don't know the word in English. Cornet, never mind. And they were like putting in some matched pistachios.
Ooh.
And I don't know if it was so delicious, but I would remember that all my life.
Wow.
That's so the first thing I had. Like,
that's the first thing you had.
Yeah. And then I spent like a whole year eating all the time.
And then you came back to Paris and you got your first waitressing job.
Yeah, because that was complicated to me to build something really... like really interesting with my Arabic studies.
Well, it got you to Paris. That was the goal.
Yeah, exactly. But after that, like, thinking about a real job with that, that was really complicated. And so I started having, like, yeah, this job in a restaurant just around the corner.
What was the restaurant?
It was called the Café Noir.
Is it still around? Or?
I think so. But the owner I was working for, so 10 years ago now, they sold the place a couple of years ago. So I don't know if it's still called the Café Noir. The place might exist.
Like, but it's totally, but it's not the same.
Probably, yeah. So I started just maybe 3 lunch a week there. That was a nightmare. That was cool, but I was so bad at it. And I don't know what they've seen, like, inside me, feeling like, we should maybe keep her, whatever. I don't know what happened, but they trusted me. And after a whole winter wondering about what I'm going to do with those studies, where should I go, what should I do?
Because you were also training to be a bookseller at the time as well.
Yeah, that was the idea I found to stop my studies and do something real, like a real job, starting something quickly. And finally, as I was talking with them about this project for the next year, they said, like, yeah, we're watching you having all those, like, idea and those project, but it's a problem for us because we think that you're made for the job. So we would love you to, like, stay with us. And I was like, fuck, that was not my plan. But after thinking a lot about it, I realized that the reason why I was waking up in the morning to walk with them was really, really more interesting and fun to me than all the rest.
What was it that you felt even in the beginning about working in the restaurant, or what was the pull, or what did you feel first thing in the morning that got you out of bed?
But that was such a pleasure to welcome and to give some pleasure to people. Like, that was the human contact. Can I say that? Like, that was the more interesting and the more enthusiastic, like, part of the job to me. And then I started, like, having a look in the kitchen and, you know, and having a look at the wine, because I didn't know anything about it before starting. So, but it was more about, like, people, like, this hospitality part of the job.
And you were there for a few years and then went over to Mama's Shelter.
Yeah, 2 years there. And then, so that was just next to the place that created the Mama's Shelter. So the owners, like, months and months before the opening, they used to come every day for lunch to this small restaurant. So this is how I met them. And so this is how I finally left to work with them. Something totally different.
Were they okay with you leaving for something else?
Or was it never a few tears? Like, nobody is never okay.
Were they, like, leave, as, like, okay as they could be?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So... No, that was totally different experience. And that was the opening, so that was crazy because they had some new ideas every day. So that was exhausting, but, like, really passionate. So 2 years there, too.
And that's where you also, you became in charge of the wine list, and that's where your education really picked up?
because nobody had time to care about it. So they said, like, oh, you seem to be a bit interesting in it. You should do it. He's like, okay.
So what were there any bottles or purveyors that you found then that are still carried here?
Sure.
Who are a couple of them?
There is some, maybe not exactly today on the shelves right now, but some guys I'm still working with, like Emmanuel Giboulot, Franz Saumon, some guys like that.
And so
some I discovered I was not working with them, but I'm still working with them today.
You were there for a couple of years and then went over to Chateaubriand, and you were the second girl, only by a
week.
I guess
I was the first one.
And how did you end up at Chateaubriand, and what year was this as well?
That was in 2010. Just by chance, because I left the mama shelter for another place where it has been like very complicated and it failed after just a few weeks. But sometimes bad experience has some good reasons. I don't think. So there is no chance, actually. So I was passing by Avenue Parmentier, so where the Chateaubriand is, with my resume, like in my bag. Like, I was totally depressed because the experience has been kind of violent and unexpected. So anyway.
Violent in what way?
But because some girls, they just ask me to work for them for months and months and months. So they were like coming every 2 weeks and like, we want you to work with us. And that was a very nice classic bistro. And I was dreaming about it because there were all these classic parts of my job that I never learned about it in a kind of like school way, you know, like école hôtelière. And so I was thinking that they could teach that to me, and I was like so excited about this new project. But there was a couple, like very complicated relationship between them. So I arrived in the middle of, like, so it's just failed. Like. So they just asked me to leave after a couple of weeks, saying like, you're really not good at the job. You should do something else in your life. And I was like, what? So I knew it was not true, but
it's still
was just
sometimes
free
hard.
And it hurts, and you wonder about it, whatever happened. So
depressed, resume and arm, turn the corner, and there's Chateaubriand.
And at the corner, there was Chateaubriand. And they were Iñaki smoking a cigarette, like, on the sidewalk, and I was like, I've heard about it. So I knew a bit who he was, but I was not in this fooding cycle. So I had no idea about like World 50 Best stuff and not that much. So I had this talk. I mean, I probably gave my resume just like straight away on the bar. It didn't had a look at it. We had like maybe an half an hour talk, and I will remember that all my life because they're like, come tomorrow for a test, like a train. Like. And the day after, in the morning, I had a message on my voicemail. Like, and it's like, and don't forget about the outfit. It's a white shirt and a 3-day beer. And I was like, oh my God, what the fuck is that place? But that was funny, and that, I'm sure it was nice, but I was like so scared. So this is how I started the day after. And every night, he didn't like tell me anything, just come back tomorrow. Okay, come back tomorrow, during 1 week. And after a week, said, this guy is going to leave at the end of the month, so you can have his job if you want. I was like, okay, but, you know. And finally, I just, like, didn't say anything. They were finishing the renovation work and preparing the opening of Le Dauphin just next door. So, like, let's see what happened. So I started at Chateaubriand like that. And finally, when they opened Le Dauphin, just 2 months after, they asked me to go at Le Dauphin because they felt like I was I would have been more comfortable and maybe the good person to be like in the middle of this small bar, like this crowded marble and mirror restaurant. So that's been, yeah, it has been such an experience too.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back and talk about opening up La Buvette and all the magic that happens here. We're going to play a song from the archives, and we'll be back in a moment here on Snacky Tunes.
Don't be alarmed, it's not the end of the world. If we're breaking the rules, it's fine. I disregard this kind of problem all the time. It's not as if it's gonna kill anyone. If there's no victim, then there's no crime. Just draw another if you think we've crossed through the line. I'm. These rules don't stop me. Forget about it, rules don't stop me. Seem unconventional sometimes. Discretion is worth a try. If you just play along, I promise we'll be fine. So leave your hang-ups back at the door. When you and I are down on the floor, well, you'll know what to do about it. These rules don't stop me.
What was it that you took from all your experience, including Lidofen and Chateaubriand, that gave you the idea or the start to open La Buvette?
Well, Chateaubriand and Le Dauphin gave me the direction on natural wine, but even more, like, can I say craft wine? And because I've been told by someone before at Mama Shelter that she's been the one that changed my life and made the wine become the only, like, the passion thing. So she's really important to
Who
me.
Who is she?
She's called Danielle Géraud, and she might be around, I would say, like 70 now. She's an old lady that always had worked in wine in Paris, in the restaurant business in Paris, selling some wine to restaurants. And the story is, if we have time to talk about it, the story is that she was working since a very long time with Alain Sandorins. You know this chef? He died just a few weeks ago, but he has been really famous for the first thing has been that he one day decided to get rid of his stars because he didn't want to keep going with depression and all like everything you have to. Sorry, I don't know how to explain that. But that's a very, very strong thing about saying officially, I don't want my stars anymore. Like, what a big deal when he did that, because I couldn't tell you, like, exactly, but maybe in the 30s or something, in the 70s, or maybe in the, like, early 80s. So he's known for that first. And then he has been one of the first chefs caring a lot about food and wine pairing. So this is how Danielle, this woman, came. Because Alain Sandorin, so this chef, was consulting for the menu at Mama Shelter. So he arrives this way, and so she arrives with him. This is how I met her. And she was already like caring a lot about like craft, but natural or not natural was not a deal for her. So I've been taught this way, like having my first poignée de raisin at Gramenon, meeting Emmanuel Giboulot the day after, but also going to De Renoncourt, new wines, like spring tasting, the day after. So that was not about like natural, there were no like church, that was just good thing made by people with conviction and a vision of doing it well. So I tried to keep that a bit, but for sure, when I really met natural wines in Chateaubriand and Le Dauphin, it has been really something. And for sure, my taste went to that more than the rest. So now there is only, but I still don't like that much talking about natural wine.
Right. I think the thing that I read about you that I liked is you like you pick wines that you adore.
Yeah, because I couldn't like sell you any wine that I'm not like totally in love with it. So yeah, that's the first reason to pick it up and to share it here, for sure.
And La Bavette was a former tea shop, right?
Yeah.
What is the story behind it and how did you get it?
The story is that it's a space I was dreaming about for years and years.
This particular space?
Yeah, this
you
particular
knew it?
Yeah.
Oh. How did you
because
come
I was
across?
Living in the neighborhood, okay. Passing by often, and that was almost closed with a kind of blue plastic fabric closing the window. It was open, and there were an old Arabic guy selling a couple of vegetables, but that was super strange because there were like maybe a tomato and two mince bouquets and a cabbage. I got this story, I love it so much. Some customers, when I opened and they first came, said like, there were a cabbage at the beginning of the winter. And as he never sold it, he was getting rid of the like the damaged leaf one by one. So at the end of the winter, the cabbage just ended like a Brussels sprout. That's I love the story. So not a lot of activities. Like. So finally, he left the shop maybe a couple of years before I took it. I don't know exactly what happened. But I was passing by, like, oh my God, this is beautiful. There was some marble furniture everywhere, like the tails on the walls and this beautiful ground. And I was so dreaming about it that I've never imagine that it could be mine one day, you know. So I focused on two other projects. Finally, it didn't work. And one day, I just passed by biking on a Sunday morning. I will remember. And there was this real estate sign on the window. So I jumped off my bike. Like I just took my phone and gave the call on a Sunday morning. But the guy was at the office. Because he was back from Hong Kong, so jet lag, so don't know, like blah, blah, blah. But I just...
For the audience in America, Sundays are not generally a work day in
yeah,
France,
sorry.
Just for context.
Yeah, exactly. So that was just this chance, like, and I had the visit the day after, and it worked. Like.
And how long from you acquiring the space to when you opened it?
That was the last day of August, and we opened on... just before Christmas.
Oh, so not that long.
No, not that long.
Very quick.
Really quick, yeah.
And what's interesting here is that it's not a bar. It's
no.
A wine shop.
It's a wine shop. Yeah, because France is complicated for that, but... No, which is cool is that you can do both. I've heard that in the US you have to choose between
it's
being
a
bottle shop, a wine shop, or a bar. Sorry. But here you can do both... But you can't get any bar license everywhere. It's kind of tricky to get some new one when you create a new place. So I'm coming from hospitality, so that was complicated to me just to create a shop where people would have like just come, pick up a bottle and leave. So this cave à manger thing, because in France we have this famous cave à manger possibility, became the best idea for the place. So I can welcome people for a glass and a small, like something to eat.
And the food here is interesting because you're not formally trained as a cook and you never wanted to present it that way. So what is the idea behind the food you can get here and what type of thinking goes into the dishes that you serve?
It's based on the fact that I have so much respect and admiration for all those guys or girls, sorry. They are real cooks, chefs, but you can also just feed people with some good stuff, even if it's not your real job or your real talent. So I discovered that through like few experiences, and I remember something really important to me has been one of the last burrata that I get at Pierre Jeancou Vivant place, with just some like aromatic flowers and a good olive oil. It has been something really important to me that made me think I can feed people even if I'm not a cook or a chef, or even if I never,
It sounds very much like the way that your mother served you and the type of way that you prepared food for the family.
Yeah, maybe that this is, yeah, maybe it came back from somewhere further than what we think. But so, and that was the good way to set all my ideas and all my envies together too.
And what does a typical food offering or a menu for any evening consist of?
There is some charcuterie and some cheese because that's what people want when they drink some wine. That's the classic offer, so it's quite hard to get rid of it. So I try to have a couple of charcuteries and a couple of cheese that I change as often as possible. Then the terrine became a classic because it's a chef. He's got this restaurant, Le Repère de Cartouche, so he's supplying few terrine for some other restaurants. And one day he suggested me to do one recipe that would be only here, like the special for La Buvette. So now he's doing that for me. I can't, like, I have to keep going with it. And it's delicious, and it became a classic, and people want it. I mean, you can't come here and not have a piece of terrine. So I try to... I love to do some small things. So I do some pickles, like with the seasons. So there is some cherries, like for now, but could be anything. I love to put everything in vinegar, actually. But so there is this terrine, there is the beans, like the famous beans that drive me crazy.
I mean, but you have to give the people what they want.
They're just a can. I don't understand, like... Everybody arrive here and they're like, can we get the beans, like the famous beans? And it's just, I mean, this is beautiful, but which is cool is that those beans, that they became like so popular and I can't explain why. But which is cool is that it's totally the quintessence, you know, you have the same word in English, of what I want to do here. Open a can, a very good one. The product inside is like beautiful, but just open a can, put a couple of things on it, and that's it. This is what I can do, like nothing more.
Last question.
Okay.
In the years that you've been open, how has the wine list evolved? What has changed? What has remained? What have you learned? How has it grown with your education and opening this place?
I met some people. So I built some special relationship too with some winemakers that I love to work with. So maybe after more than 4 years, I'm not anymore in searching some new things all the time, because my deep relationship with some of them is more important. So, but at the same time, the selection is moving all the time. You have a new vintage of something, then you have, so people never get bored. That's not the problem. And also the natural aspect of it has been maybe made more by the clients than me, because sometimes you realize that people expectation drives you somewhere to, like, I don't know how to explain that exactly, but, and also maybe one of the particularity of it is that I try to focus on the young generation, if I could say. So I always want to drink a glass of René Moss or Thierry Puzelat, because when it's good, it's fucking good. So I don't want to act like I don't care about, like, the guy that started, and I'm full of respect for them because they started, and so this is because of them that we're doing what we're doing today. So that's not the point. But also trying to share the work of some new guys, like, they're less known, they're starting slowly. Like, a first vintage won't be perfect, but so charming at the same time. So, yeah, that would be a balance between all that.
Well, thank you for letting us come in.
My pleasure.
On an afternoon. It was great talking with you. Where can people find you, social media, follow you, come visit you? How do they get a hold of you? Instagram?
Yeah, could be. Or come here, that's the best way.
Perfect.
I mean, Instagram is a bit virtual. Like.
Yes.
The best way is to come here, definitely.
Perfect. Well, we're going to take a quick musical break from the archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes.
We are going to the
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Annie Hart in studio. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Some of you might remember Annie from being on here many, many years ago with her band Avoir Simone, and also did Dinner with the Band with us, and was on the second time, and just has been around. We've hung out. We've known each other for a long time.
It's always nice to see you.
It's always nice to see you, too. No one can see you shrug on air, though. You're just kind of shrugging.
I was curtsying.
Oh, curtsying. Annie, you put out a record this weekend.
I did on Friday. Well, my record label put it out.
Yeah, but you had some small part in it.
I did a little bit. I, like, did all the legwork. Wrote it, recorded it, had it ready.
Who did the artwork?
I did the artwork. Oh,
okay.
But the photograph was taken by my friend's daughter, who I think is like 15 now or 16.
Did she get paid?
I paid her $100.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you think she put it into like a savings bond or just blew it like straight out?
I really hope she did. I hope she like just was just like, boom, savings bonds.
Or maybe she framed it, which also has no value. Or then you can give her like a fake $100 bill.
Well, I sent her a check. I didn't even check if it was cash yet.
Oh, got to balance those
She's
books.
Also modeling. Her name is Sophie Jurowitz. She's so beautiful. So oh. I think she's got some money in the bank. I don't know if my $100 means anything.
Right. She just wanted to say she did an album cover.
She's the best. I love her. I've known her since she was 2.
When did you start working on this record?
I started working on this record when I was, seriously, when I was pregnant with my daughter, who is now 2.5.
And what was the desire? This is your first solo record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything had before been written with Erica and Heather. Where did these songs start to come from, or where did you feel that these were going to be placed in your canon of work?
That's a really good question. I kind of felt just an impetus from being pregnant to... Well, okay. So, well, before that, I kind of, since I was about 6 or 7 when I got my first small Casio keyboard or knockoff Casio keyboard. I think I had the Radio Shack version for Christmas 1 year. I've been writing songs since then. And then I've just constantly been doing it, always doing it, never stop. I'm always thinking of songs. I'm always thinking in song. It's kind of annoying to be around me because I'll be like, time to tie your shoes. And and then, sorry, that's not...
It's really funny.
That's not... I just... That was improvised. So...
Your kids are like, no, it's not, Mom.
Actually, we have a different song that I'm not going to get into that my mother wrote. But anyway, so I kind of always write songs. And I, you know, some of these for this album, I was kind of thinking they would be for Avoir Simone. And then that kind of like took a turn when Heather moved to California and Erica wanted to focus on her family. And so I... Actually, it was Heather who was, and Keith Murray from We Are Scientists, who we just heard 2 songs ago, who I actually dedicated this album to them because they both were really angry at me when I would play them demos and I'd be like, I don't know, I guess I'll just listen to it on my iPod. And they were like, first of all, nobody uses iPods anymore. Second of all, you have to play these for the world. You're really doing the world a disservice by keeping them to yourself. And they literally were just sending me angry text messages all the time telling me that I really needed to focus on this. So I did it, and I'm really glad I listened to them because I'm happy with how it turned out.
And how has the writing process evolved going to a solo project, but also evolved as becoming a mother and just, you know, you're thinking about songs or your lyric approach or the way in which you craft the music?
I think you'll hear this from almost every parent, is that once you have children, you never understand how much free time you had before and your efficiency. I've always been obsessed with efficiency and doing things in an efficient manner and a logical order, like getting the Thanksgiving dinner on the table in the right order is really, I'm good at that. But I think like once you have kids, you're just like, boom, forced to create in these bizarro pockets of time. So you have like when the kids are napping, you have like, I do my vocal exercises every day when the kids are having their breakfast. You know, that kind of thing where it's like, they're distracted. I'm just going to go ahead and do this. And you kind of like make things work with what you have.
Do you think, I mean, we always talk about how constraints always breed creativity. And when you have so much time, nothing ever happens, but it's in those moments. So do you feel that the creative output became even bigger because you had those constraints versus when you didn't have kids? Or do you think it was a different type of creative output, or how did that evolve and change?
Well, there's definitely a drive. It's kind of like if you're not creating in those pockets of time and you're like me, where you're a creative person and you don't really have like a 9-to-5 day job, what would you think of yourself if you weren't? I mean, I'm a workaholic and I'm very into creating and like, we're all going to die. Let's make stuff. Let's go for it. And so I think, you know, you just like, I'm definitely driven by that. Like, what am I doing in this pocket of time? Am I vacuuming the floor or am I going to listen to some beautiful synth sounds?
It's vacuuming the floor, right?
My floor is so clean. I actually wrote a song recently about clean floors, but whatever.
Not on the record, though?
No, I think it's going to be on the next record, but it's kind of, I'm so morbid. It's like, if you have clean floors, what have you accomplished with your life? It's basically the crux of the song. But I mean, if you enjoy clean floors, you've accomplished a lot because you've made yourself happy. But me, I don't care.
And you recorded this record in the basement when the kids were asleep.
Yeah.
So mostly a headphone record masterpiece.
You know, definitely a lot of headphones, but I don't want to brag, but we have a house. So the kids are on the second floor and I'm in the basement. So we can, you know, there's monitors.
There's monitors, there's time, you know, low volumes, so you don't wake the kids.
The other day I tweeted, I was like, I'm doing this new recording project, and I was like recording tambourine for it really loud, and I was like, oh my God, the baby's sleeping, and I'm just like jamming this tambourine at top volume.
They'll appreciate it.
She slept through it.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah. Do you want to hear a moody song about my second boyfriend ever?
Of course. Maybe he's listening. What?
You come with me again because you're dying to. to be free, and I come with you again because it comes so easily. Meet me under the water, then you'll meet me all the way down. First you
Talk about this record being created in the public eye. Why did you choose that approach, and how public is public?
Well, I mean, I guess you saw that I wrote that on Instagram the other day.
I did. Well, I thought it was interesting.
Well, because I guess it relates a lot to what I was saying before, which is how, for me, it's very natural to create. When I was a child, I was homeschooled and I had a lot of free time, and I would play piano and just play for myself, play by myself, play chord progressions that I enjoyed hearing. And no matter how many times people told me or would sit and listen or tell me it was great, I just couldn't even comprehend that it was on par with anything that a professional or somebody else who was quote unquote good would put out there. And I still, you know, it's funny. It's like I waffle between the feelings. You know, I listen to pretty weird music that, like, you know, a lot of people are making in their bedrooms, that it means a lot to me. And it's not necessarily like the world's greatest music, but to me, it's the world's greatest music. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, it's hard for me to find that kind of, like, that this is my talent or this is what I'm good at. Like, I feel like I used to volunteer a lot washing dishes in soup kitchens, and I kind of feel like that is like a much more useful place for me to put my energy and time. But, like, unfortunately I'm kind of chained to the house with the kids and whatnot, so I can't, like, do stuff like that all the time. So, like, even just putting out what I've made, it's very revealing, especially, like, a lot of these are literal songs about my literal life and, like, when it was not so good. And, like, even just thinking about those things and maybe crying on stage because it's still really raw for me, like, that's a weird thing to do with your time.
Did you think it was maybe easier when there were two other people on stage and you could say, oh, that song's not about me, it's about the other one? And this one, it's all about you because there's no one else to deflect it from?
You know, it's funny, like, a lot of Au Simone songs, the ones that I wrote, some of them were just, like, complete fictional tales that, you know, mountain goat style, kind of like, here's a place that I'm thinking of, and this is a scenario that might have happened there. But what was really different is being on stage and, like, I'm with these, like, incredible, leggy, beautiful singers swaying, and I can just, like, be, like, the freak in the corner and feel totally natural doing that because I'm like, well, nobody's looking at me. And so lately,
I don't know if I would agree with that, but sure.
But when I first started playing, I was so a solo. I was so embarrassed. I had, like, several, like, totally choking, just staring at the keyboard being like, what's a black key and what's a white key? Wait, what? Oh my God, what's the meaning of life? Ah! Like in the basement of Cake Shop.
A chord, you say.
Yeah, a chord?
A chord?
Does it start with a K?
So why do you think that these songs had to be all true narratives or from your past as opposed to a fictional place and a time?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that happened that led me to this place. One is that a friend of mine who encouraged me all the time and was kind of like, not a literal slap in the face, but like, we'd get a little angry when I said like, oh, whatever I make is just garbage anyway. And he died. And it really impacted me, and that like, I should kind of like honor his vision of me. So that was one thing. Sorry, I lost track of the question.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
But this is the other thing I was going to say, is that I felt like from that place, like I got kind of into like Buddhist philosophy and meditating, and I kind of felt like I started coming at this place of forgiveness to your past self, where like I had not, I was like always beating myself up. And like from here, so like a lot of these songs I'm writing about are kind of like dedicated to my younger self. Like, don't beat yourself up over this. You were 20 years old. Of course you dated a stalker. That's fine. Like, that's cool. It's done. You did the best you could. So this is a song called I Don't Want Your Love. And this guy wasn't a stalker, but this guy was not treating me right. And I've come to this place where, like, I deserve to be treated right.
One of the cooler moments of summer, sitting on my couch watching TV, a certain show by the name of Twin Peaks. Who do I see but a band that I thought broke up many moons ago, Alvar Simone.
We were on hiatus.
You were on hiatus. Also,
one day. You're going to see us again.
I can't wait. I still know all the lyrics.
Aww.
But also, didn't really kind of put two and two together when you wrote me, like, I'm going to be in LA for the Twin Peaks premiere. And I was like, that's cool. She's a fan, aren't we all? How did that come about? What is the story behind you getting on the show and being at the Roadhouse?
Yeah, so I don't know if you know this, but I think one of the biggest reasons that Au Revoir Simone became popular, I mean, we already had kind of a following at that point, but David Lynch is a huge Au Revoir Simone fan.
Unknown to me.
Oh, he's like, he went on like a speaking engagement after his book came out, Catching the Big Fish, and he would just tell people, hey, you know what you should do? You should listen to this band. He literally did that all the time.
It's amazing.
I mean, you can't beat that. And, you know, he's became a friend of ours and just is just like such a positive force in our lives that, you know, we always like quietly were waiting for the phone call, but we thought like maybe one day we would compose a song or something for a movie, you know?
Right. Or just have a song placed in a movie.
Right.
Which would be amazing.
Anything.
Sure.
We would just like take it. But you know, it came out that he was working on Twin Peaks and I was like, oh, okay. That's fine. Kind of that kind of feeling. And then I remember I was on the subway right when the subway got internet. And I was with somebody, and I was like, oh my God, you're never going to guess what's going to happen. And then I told this person who like, I know, but he's not like one of my closest friends. And then I kept reading the email and it was like, whatever you do, do not tell another living human that this is happening. And I was
so
like,
so you murdered that person.
He's no longer with us.
Oh, that's so unfortunate.
But he was a really nice guy.
I'm sure he was.
No, but I kept it a huge secret. I didn't even tell my parents.
And when did you record it?
We recorded it. Oh, I'm really bad with time, but okay. I'm pretty sure I did it about last fall.
And was the setting that all the bands came in at one time or how was it recorded?
Yeah, I'm sure they must have done some others, but I know they had like 2 days booked at the Roadhouse where they like filmed everybody in a row. And I feel really bad. David's assistant was like, you girls, you're just like family. You should stay and just like, you can totally listen to all the bands. Julie's coming down, blah, blah, blah. And we saw a couple bands and we're like, we've got places to go. So we left and then I'm like, Nine Inch Nails were there and I missed it.
Eddie Vedder.
I'm kicking myself. Eddie Vedder.
Did you get to watch any of the Chromatics?
We saw the Chromatics. They were amazing and they're super nice people.
And how did the song selection go? I mean, it was interesting, the songs, I mean, super deep from your collection. It makes a lot more sense now because he's such a fan. But did he give any explanation why he chose the songs that he did?
You know, we filmed Flammable, Lark, and I think we filmed Sad Song. We filmed the third song from Bird of Music. And that was the album that we were touring on when we did this event with him in Barnes & Noble. And I think that he like got married to one of the songs on the record. Like, I think he just really loves that record. So I don't know. I think that those two really fit the vibe.
No, of course. I mean, if whoever watched the show, the lyrics of all the performances actually tied into the episode, into mm-hmm. the overall thing. They weren't just, here's a cool band playing a cool song, that actually fit the theme. So I was curious just how deeply he went over. Was a conversation? He said, do you have any songs like this? Or they asked for those songs.
No, he knew the songs. He just asked for those songs.
That is incredible. Moving on.
I didn't realize there was such a cult around him. Now that I was in the show, yeah. Everybody's just like, like the texts on the phone.
I think I wrote you and Erica. I was like, holy shit. I can't believe it. I was like, this is insane. Like, just totally surprised. Not surprising, but just like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
And then once it started, you're like, oh, this makes total sense.
Yeah. It didn't make sense. Yeah. I guess I'm part of culture.
You are part of culture. So the record Impossible Accomplice is out.
Yeah.
And you are going on tour in October.
Yeah, I'm playing the Brooklyn Night Bazaar opening for Wild Pink and Matt Pond PA on the 25th.
There's a song by Matt Pompeo called Summer is Coming that is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Oh, I hope he plays it. Do you want to come? I'll put you on the list.
Perfect. Okay. I would love to. Great.
If he said no on air, audience, I would have been really mad. Man, I'm busy.
I'm busy. Do you say the 24th? I got plans. So there, and then, but then you're going east and then you're going west.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of like not doing the East Coast of America. I'm playing Margate to this festival by the sea in UK, and then playing London, I'm playing Paris, and then I'm opening up for this band, The Deers, and we're going to Oxford, Manchester, Newcastle, Glasgow, and then I'm coming to California. So I'll be in LA, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and then Whidbey Island, which I never heard of, which is apparently like a magical island. I'm assuming there's unicorns.
By the way, in Margate, there is a fish shack that's been there since like the 1950s that is absolutely incredible.
You're the first American I've ever talked to who knows where Margate is.
I did a day trip there.
Ah, everybody from London is moving there. All my friends live there now.
So many people. Well, Stephen from Moshi Moshi,
our mutual friend,
has a house out there.
Yeah.
Well, I want to make sure that we have time to get one more song in, but
boom.
Where can people get the record? Oh, find it, stream it, follow you on Instagram, see you, all the stuff.
Oh my God. I'm on Instagram at Annie Hart for sure. F-O-R spelled out. Somebody asked me that the other day. Yeah, it's on Spotify. It's not available on vinyl or CD. It's only available on cassette from my Bandcamp page if you need a physical one. But you can get it digitally at, you know, iTunes, whatever, Amazon. One of them's going to be mad I didn't give them a shout out. Google Play.
They'll be fine.
Deezer.
Deezer, they're all fine.
What is Deezer?
It's not big in the States, but it's big everywhere else.
Okay.
I want to give a warm thank you to Camille from La Bouvette. Please make sure that if you are in town this week to check out her events at Mission Chinese and Achilles Heels. If you like this and you want to hear more Snacky Tunes episodes, please go into our archives. And if you want to, leave us a nice little review and give us 5 stars. We will be back next week with a brand new episode of Snacky Tunes. Annie, what is the name of the song you are going to take us out on?
Breathing Underwater.
Perfect. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week.
Feel the feeling. We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.